extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Wow, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I am Andrew Weeby with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, David Goss, three-man show, little tiki-taka here, playing in triangles, talking Atlanta United. Because, wow, we hit Joseph Martinez on the last show, the feud with Gabriel Heinze, and, well, that feud paid off in the same way the Josie Altidore feud did, which is that the manager has lost his job. So we'll talk about the changes in Atlanta. That's the big story. So much more coming. The Invincibles are dead. Long live the Invincibles. Josie's back, and Josie's scoring goals. Gianluca Busio looks like he's sold. And, of course, we're not going to talk much Gold Cup here because we did our reaction show on Sunday night, which is also out wherever you listen to podcasts. But one little note from that, Dave. Almost El Salvador. Almost.
I know.
Hugo Perez. He's bringing in the boys, man. And
Anders, you can check me on this because you will know better than I. But I think a show recently, last 2 weeks, we were talking about World Cup qualifying and games where the U.S. will control possession and where they won't. And I said El Salvador on the road will be tough. And I'm pretty sure Charlie and then all of you shut me down and were like, that's going to be an easy game. That's unacceptable. This is the U.S. men's national team. Right? Right? Yeah, Doyle knows. Doyle would not smile that way if it wasn't true.
I'm glad that Charlie caught the first punch in that one because I was right there with him.
Oh, man. You gotta watch out for those strays, right?
That wasn't a stray, Weeby. That was targeted. La Selecta were awesome in that game against Mexico, and it's befitting of a team with the best fullback in the region. I think we could all agree, Alex Roldan, easily the best fullback.
Well, it was a three-way tug of war on the international front, and right? El Salvador won that fight, and here they're getting the dividends.
They were so good. They were so good, man.
I did not believe in any way that they could keep the energy that they had in the first half hour.
Yeah, well,
I thought they were going to keel over. I was like, there's no way that this can, like, Mexico will win this 4-0 just because the amount of energy that they are expending. And except for this,
I've been to a ton of El Salvador games. Great crowds. I have never seen Mexico outdrawn in this region.
Oh, yeah. They were outdrawn in this game. If you were watching Mexican national team Twitter last night, which is usually just as crazy as US national team Twitter, so it's like that type of thing. Everybody was kind of in awe, including the journalists, saying that this is an away game for Mexico. The El Salvador fans turned out and they turned up at that game. It was really, really impressive. I'm like, every level from El Salvador, and like now I'm that like at El Salvador at the Cuscatlan, that is the
first
game for the U.S. national team in World Cup qualifying.
I already knew, but in my mind, there are guys that I don't think you risk for the U.S. in that game that have never been in an environment like that because it's going to be wild. Also, I'm sorry Kalen's not here because we could have also dragged Carlos de los Cobos for not doing this with El Salvador over the last few years. But shout out to Kalen. Have a good trip.
I will say, as someone who's been to, and we all have, to a ton of incredible soccer games, the best, most fun, most jacked up crowd I've ever been a part of, as a fan at least, is Roma El Salvador Red Bull Arena. And it was a party. From minute one to minute 90, it was an absolute party. Almost for them. Almost. But they're moving on. They got a chance in the Gold Cup and, of course, in World Cup qualifying. The full reaction to U.S.-Canada is on the podcast feed. If you listen to the pod, it's also on YouTube. Check that out. Of course, we are doing live reaction after every single U.S. national team knockout round going forward, but then also World Cup qualifying as well. Twitter spaces before the game to react to the lineup. Full coverage via Extra Time Club and Country. Driven by Continental Tire, baby.
Warning, we are not skipping it. There is a week off in this tournament.
I know, yeah.
I have never seen this before.
No, that's not true. It's Tuesday. Today's Monday.
No,
Tuesday,
but for these teams, they get a full week off for the U.S. and Canada until next Sunday, which will be, I think the U.S. is at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. So we'll be on pre and post on that. But, like, I thought I was missing something in my calendar, and I was like,
nope.
it's going to be one of these days where I'm like, oh, crap, I forgot. And it's
Costa
literally
Rica and Jamaica
away.
Are probably like, I thought we were missing something too. Why do we only have 5 days of rest here? This is ridiculous. Anyway, big show coming up here. Be sure to check out at MLSsoccer.com. Of course, that Club and Country show, it's there as well. Podcast feeds, YouTube as well. I was missing this morning my armchair analyst. That's how I start every single Monday morning. But it's not there. There is a recap of the U.S. and the Gold Cup group stage, Doyle. What else is coming this week from you?
A big old story, because we're just about at the midpoint of the season, a little shy of that, taking a look at what's been good and what's been bad for each and every MLS team so far. And like, there are a couple of teams where it was legitimately hard to find something bad to say. The only bad thing for the Sounders this year has been the injuries. Like, the only bad thing for the Revs this year has been like a little bit of underperformance from the wingers. You know, like it's been a really weird year. So it was good to go through each and every team and take kind of a pretty big look into most of them and sort of reset my head for where they're at and what we've seen so far this year. And it was long. It's like a 7,000 word.
Do you think that so I did my All-Star ballot. I tried to. And it felt like the Eastern Conference. It feels like the gap between the East and the West right now is different than what we've seen in past years. Or is it always like this one conference is fairly stronger top to bottom?
And you feel like the East is stronger top to bottom?
One through seven. And with the West, it's like Seattle. And then the Galaxy have started well. And KC. Mm-hmm.
I mean, LAFC have won three in a row. They're starting to look the part. Minnesota.
So I'm wrong is what you're telling me. I'll appreciate that answer.
Portland has, getting guys back.
Go look at Minnesota's wins, though. All the wins that they have are against, like, basically bottom supporter shield level teams. Seattle was the first win in this run that's been any good.
And I think, not to disrespect, because RSL started well, I think two of those three wins for LAFC have been against RSL.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It felt that way for a second, but I think I feel that way every year with one of the conferences.
Used to be that the West always had it, and now it seems like it's shifted back to the East. There's always a debate.
I do think that the East is probably a little bit better this year, but I don't think it's much of a gap at all. Yeah.
But look at that professional transition there from David Goss. Get your 2021 MLS All-Star Game ballot presented by Target in. You have a full 11 to vote for. We did it on one of our previous shows here, put the extra time ballot out. It was like pulling teeth. But you can do left and right back on this one. You have to. That's great. Defensive midfield, once again, you have to put that player in. So go check it out. MLSsoccer.com, the MLS app. Get your ballot in. You can vote once per day. So look, if you want to pack it up, pack it up. If you just want to do it once, just do it once, but make your voice heard. All right, let's get to the big winner in MLS in week 13. That's the Supersonics in the Extra Time Fantasy League, 108 points. Captain Hani Mukhtar, which, I mean, I guess, look, they're playing the fire. You captain the guy you think is going to pay off from the mistakes, and Hani paid off. He had a hat trick this week, and he had Mason Toy, too, who played really well for the Montreal, I almost said it, Club de Foot. Club de Foot. I'm wearing the jersey, and I almost said it. So well done to the Supersonics. The loser this weekend, it's got to be Gabriel Heinze. It is over. After a 1-0 loss to the Revs, the release came out, the tweets rolled in, the reaction rolled in, the hot takes were not far behind. Gabriel Heinze is out at Atlanta United after 13 games, about 8 months. They were shut out in four of the past five games. Were Atlanta United, after they were turning a new leaf from the Frank DeBoer, they were supposed to be more exciting, more engaging, more successful. They really weren't any of those things so far. Right now, 10th in the Eastern Conference, 13 points, 1 point per game. They are only 4 points out from New York City in 7th. But it was a much bigger story, it seems, for Gabriel Heinze. And, of course, we talked all about the Josef Martinez. I don't know if feud is the right word. I don't think it is. Disconnect. Whatever it is, Josef Martinez.
Seemed like a feud. Joseph and Joseph's friends were certainly spiking the ball on Twitter this weekend like it was a feud.
Julian Gressel hitting with the picture of Josef Martinez with all his trophies with just the crown emoji.
If we were to do current player Twitter power rankings, like Julian Gressel is like top tier. He sneaks in there every now and again. I digressed. Go ahead.
Yamil Assad did the PK hop. So he was throwing it back there. And DC United apparently looking down the Eastern Seaboard being like, what is going down there? We got support for our boys. So here's a quote from Joe Patrick over at Dirty South Soccer in a column he wrote with takeaways from this news. And I think it pretty much encapsulates what happened here. Quote, it's flat out embarrassing to have to fire a head coach less than 8 months after unveiling him as the savior of what was a dismal 2020 season. And that's the way it went. And then we, before we really dig in here and pile on perhaps Gabriel Heinze, should probably take some mea culpas as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because we, like everyone else, and I remember these shows distinctly. I remember the feeling that I had of like, oh, my God, what an ambitious hire. What an incredible hire. Atlanta United is back. They're going to be XYZ. Ezequiel Barco is going to, you know, take the jumps we expected. Marcelino Moreno is going to be the player that they signed and said he was. Joseph Martinez is going to get healthy and be Joseph Martinez again. We were wrong. Straight up, we were wrong.
Yeah. And I think most people were. Right. But that's also from the outside on resume and not actually on how does he fit and what's the state of the club? Because while you talk about, oh, 8 months ago, he was hired to be the savior. No, this is Frank de Boer all connected. This is now one era of chaos at Atlanta United. And while de Boer won a couple trophies early because of the Tata Martino team that continued with him to an extent, this now cannot be focused on just the managers. And there is a ton to focus on Gabriel Heinze. He has left a fair amount of breadcrumbs for the insanity that was, it seems like, his time in Atlanta. But you got to look at the club overall. Mm-hmm. And then ask the question, was it set up for Heinze to succeed? And where Heinze maybe had mistakes and failed, was there enough guidance from the rest of the club? Is there too much influence for the coach? You have to look bigger than just Heinze to say now for this club over the course of 2.5-3 years, it's been one of the worst in Major League Soccer, coming off the first 2 years, which were historic for an expansion franchise.
Yeah, I think look, a lot of pressure is on Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra right now. I think it is probably understood that both those guys are sitting on relatively hot seats themselves. I think Boca's in the last year of his contract, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm sure there will be more reporting on that to come, but they obviously got it wrong with Heinze just as we did. And I mean, when this hire happened, right, I went back to the same people I talked to before the Scalotto hire for the Galaxy, who to a man said it might work out for him, but he's really kind of a nothing manager who just rolls his guys out there and doesn't have tactics, so I wouldn't expect it to work out. And I kind of poo-pooed that at the time. I thought there has to be more to a guy who, you know,
you're talking about Scalotto right now.
Yes, who won so much with Boca Juniors, and I was wrong, and they were right. So I went back to all these same guys who I talked to, and said you guys were right about Scalotto, and I talked to them about the Heinze hire, and they're like, he's going to be great in MLS. He's just going to kill it in MLS. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to trust you guys this time. And I went back, I went through Y Scout and I watched, all the old highlights, and you look at his resume and everything. Boy, we were all wrong. We were all just like disastrously wrong. And I do think that Arthur Blank in particular deserves a lot of credit for listening to his people and understanding that like the sunk cost fallacy is a fallacy. If something is as broken as Heinze's tenure with Atlanta already clearly was, you have to get out of it. You have to get out of it. And I think he deserves a ton of credit for, cutting ties that quickly and, obviously going in a new direction. And now all the pressure is on Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra to get it right, because they've gotten it wrong twice in a row. And in the process of getting it wrong, they have also dismantled that great 2018 team that was one of the best in league history. Darlington Nagbe is gone. LGP is gone. Tito Villalba is gone. The fullbacks are gone. And Joseph Martinez was damn near gone. Like, that's so much that has just been taken apart over the past 3 years. And it's made Atlanta a much less interesting and, frankly, a much less talented team, because these guys aren't gone with no replacements. They're gone with replacements who have been significantly worse players significantly worse players at almost every position.
Well, and you have to mention he didn't there. Miguel Almirón, yeah, you sold him, but you had the golden parachute. You had this incoming amount of money and flexibility and ability to spend that it, just from an outgoing transfer, I don't think, clearly no MLS team has ever had. And that money has not come good.
No.
So I agree with you 100%. But I think to Doyle's point, Miguel Almirón is almost unreplaceable because of what he did. All these other pieces that they've missed on, if they were somewhat close on, or if they had kept those guys, they would still be highly competitive in MLS.
Yeah.
If you took Miguel Almirón out of that MLS Cup winning team and you kept Nagby and you kept Kressel and you kept LGP and you kept Tito Villalba, you would have been competitive over the last 2.5-3 years, and you would still be right now. And that's the part that's frustrating. And I think about LGP and the mess that was Fernando Meza and getting him in, and now he's out on loan and he's done because he's not a part of this.
Well, now the potential mess that Alan Franco is
exactly.
As well. Because you went and signed Gabriel Heinze's players. You gave him the resources that he said he needed. You went and got Sosa. You went and got him. He has not lived up to any of the reputation that he had. To all the, you know, the will they, won't they, how are they going to get this deal done, that was preseason, as we talked about that, this missing piece that we kept talking about. Here's Darren Neal's on the situation. He says that the issues with Joseph, let's call them, weren't a factor in the decision. And in fact, Joseph did rejoin training on Sunday with Gabriel Heinze. He was back in training on that one. Here's a quote from Darren Neal's. The reality is that this happens throughout the world of sports. Some managers will fit at certain clubs and some won't fit. You don't know until they are in the club. And all the reporting now that's coming out, Doug McIntyre, newly over at Fox, had a big one this morning. Felipe Cardenas has been all over this as well. There's a lot to dig through in that sense. The reporting is that the Major League Soccer Players Association filed a grievance with the league for multiple infractions related to how Heinze handled the team's training schedule. Basically, he wasn't giving enough days off per the CBA. The same thing happened with Tata Martino. The same thing happened about that. There was no comment from any of the parties on that. There is now reporting from Doug over at Fox that there was a limit on the amount of water that they could drink in practice, and that they had to answer their phones and be available at a moment's notice to get to the training facility, even on guaranteed off days and other days where they were given the chance to be away. There was a lot of talk right now about sort of his relationship, Heinze's, with the other people within the club. The media side has been well documented. He did not, certainly in the preseason, seemed to particularly enjoy or prioritize speaking to the media, but it sounds like it went outside of that. The anonymous quote that I keep going back to in Doug's piece is, it was hell every day for 6 months.
Yikes.
I mean, that's a lot. And there's another quote in that piece that's basically that the off-field burden, mental burden, was just dominated everything they did. You saw guys get injured in trainings. He was doing two-a-days for a long time as well. I mean, it sounds like it was just a slow build of a lot of things. And Felipe has reported that Heinze, I'm trying to think of the right word. Maybe stubborn is the right word. Maybe dogmatic is the right word. But you saw it in the Joseph situation. It really did feel like a king of the castle. This is my place, my decisions, my way. And in the end, that didn't work out.
And the only, I guess, silver lining you can hope for Atlanta fans is that if you take all that away, the talent might actually be okay, right? If you don't have two-a-days and have everyone be injured, maybe this team actually is okay. If they're not miserable all the time and have zero time off, maybe they will be good enough to compete for a playoff spot in MLS. Because as much as we knock everything they've done, Santiago Sosa is a good player. Right, Franco Ibarra looks like a solid piece. We don't know enough about Alan Franco. Brooks Lennon's been a pretty good pickup for them as well. George Bello, Miles Robinson away with national team. Like, again, if guys are healthy and available to this team, there is probably a better team in there than what we have seen over the last few weeks.
And if Joseph Martinez is motivated and has a fire in his belly and is doing what he did for Frank DeBoer, as we discussed in the last one, which is just put the entire club on his back, you got a chance. And that's where it goes to what you said, Doyle, about Arthur Blank and the front office making this decision. They are only a few points out of the playoffs. Mm-hmm. This season is nowhere close to lost, but it seems like the belief internally that's now coming and being like the cards are being shown externally is that they felt that was slipping away.
So I can understand you don't maybe want to empower Joseph too much in this moment by saying, well, this is why this happened, but they lost to New England 1-0. That's the best team of the Eastern Conference. You don't fire a manager off the back of a performance and result like that when you're a few points out of the playoffs, as you said. Obviously, points per game a little bit tougher without something else going on.
Yeah, this was the eruption. This
like,
was the
Chris
billing...
Armas lost to DC 5-1, and he got fired.
Wasn't
not
1-0
to the Revs. 7-1, sorry.
Yeah.
It's not 1-0 to the Revs.
Yeah, this was the eruption. The pressure was building internally for a long time, and only those inside saw it. And, you know, we were all surprised when the Joseph Martinez stuff came out, but I didn't see that in a week that this was going to happen. I wasn't that tuned in. I didn't see that coming. So now what, Doyle? Like, what is the best sort of manager for Atlanta United, for this squad, for this project to settle down, you know, a volcanic zone that you're like, I don't want to go in there right now. Like, there's lava everywhere. Like,
so what we've seen from the last two is, I mean, Frank de Boer had, you know, unquestionable success with Ajax. He had a high profile. He had a very clear style of play. He had no ability to navigate MLS waters. And he also had, you know, kind of a history of failure at other spots.
Anders about to cut us off with the clip of Mourinho saying he's the worst manager.
he's just kicking himself right now. It's like, I always have that queued up.
I read something, some quote from the worst manager in the history of the Premier League, Frank de Boer.
Oh,
that is
he was
an
ready for
all-star performance from Anders.
You always got to have it ready. Always, just in case.
I mean, make Anders the manager at this point.
Yeah, sir.
So they went with that with Frank de Boer, who, you know, I've seen reports that he is the worst manager in the history of the Premier League. Then they, you know, went with Gabriel Heinze, who's a big name, who had a big reputation in South America, despite not a long track record. Again, no ability to navigate MLS. Just didn't have it. I mean, I think it points pretty clearly that they need someone who has some familiarity with the league. I don't know. I mean, you know, former Dynamo players are assembling on Twitter to say hire Dom Kinnear, and I understand the impetus behind that, but like Dom Kinnear hasn't really had success in MLS in a decade.
If,
you know,
if the Galaxy weren't going to keep him after he coached there,
right.
I don't know that Atlanta's going to go out and bring him in.
I think Dom Kinnear at this point is like a very good assistant to have somewhere, but it wouldn't. Maybe in Atlanta as an assistant. But they need someone who has a track record of success in this league, who has shown that they could do it. Someone who has won big, maybe even won a trophy recently in MLS. And, you know, given those parameters, I think the only man for the job is Chris Armas, 2018 Supporters Shield winner. He was beloved of Atlanta United fans for the role he played in getting Atlanta United to MLS Cup that year.
You hear the tenor in his voice change as he goes through the bit.
And just
where now you're
in
bit tired.
Like, initially, like, you see the little smile and you're like, is it or is it not? Well, but that's the issue, right, for Atlanta United, is that there really isn't like there's no Bruce Arena just like posted up waiting for his next job and trying to pick and choose, right?
And there's no Greg Vanney to the LA Galaxy where you're like, duh. Now, part of that is Atlanta's a newer club, and so you don't have a club legend who's been around, who's now coaching, who can step right in.
The obvious one is Dome. Dome, that team for 2 years in NYC, with NYCFC, they played really, really good soccer. And he left because I think he was a little upset at the lack of resources that he was getting. You're not going to lack resources with Atlanta United. The thing is, Dome is super stubborn. He has that same reputation, not to the degree that I think Heinze was. I mean, no other coaches were calling him an a-hole after games. But he proved over a couple years that he could get a team to play at basically a Supporters Shield pace in MLS. He was Pep's right-hand man for a decade. And I think that you need to sell it to the supporters, whoever you're hiring. You need to sell that to the supporters and saying Pep Guardiola's right-hand man. That still carries some cachet.
I don't think don't even think you'd have to sell that. I think that the Atlanta fans who are in tune enough with MLS, which we know there are a ton, will understand it. And the ones who don't, they just want to see this team win. Like, I think it would be fairly simple if he wanted to come. Plus, he loves to tear down a roster and take 6 months. So he's got a perfect scenario to come into.
But here's the other thing about that. When you say tear down a roster, like I don't personally know, and maybe you're right, Doyle, about Carlos Bocanegra's contract status. But the pressure is clearly on the front office at Atlanta United to get those decisions right as far as the coaching side goes. But also, and they're not in a good time period to do it, by the way, right now in this moment. Like, this isn't the best time probably to hire that manager. But also, they've got to get the personnel side. So how do you, there's like, your timelines are off, right? Like, this just not quite right. Like, are you going to get more money to go get different players now when you just went and invested a bunch of money on the whims of Gabriel Heinze, and you have a bunch of money and DP spots tied up in players that the plan was to flip down the line, but now the flip seems much less likely than it was before? Like, the timing is all off with all of this. So if you're a new coach coming in, how much flexibility, how much do you really have? Unless you truly do just rip it all down. And if you're going to rip it all down, are you giving – you know, Darren and Carlos, are they going to rip it down with you? What's going to happen? I don't know. What's going to happen?
No, so, I mean, this is a team in limbo.
There's no stability. Yeah.
So you think it has to be an internal hire, which means you're talking
Steven Glass is gone
style, bring Carlos Bocanegra down.
Well, that's actually a good point, right? Because you were there in Kansas City when Peter Vermees, we're a dozen years ago now, Peter Vermees had hired Kurt Anolfo, who was not a great coach. And it came to the point where they, you know, ownership said to Peter, this is your roster. We want you to coach it.
Yeah, but I also think that ownership group had at that time and still has this immense sort of respect and belief in Peter. And I think their thing was not like, you come in, you got to fix this is going to pot. I think their thing was, we believe that you are the right person. We don't actually want you to go hire someone else. We think that if you did this job, you would be so good that you would change the fortunes of this club. And we think that in this moment, as we are transitioning and changing our identity and opening up a new stadium, that you and your connection with Kansas City, because remember, Peter, I mean, it's not like Bocanegra had years as being a legend and winning an MLS Cup for Atlanta United. Peter is a club legend for the Wizards. He's living in Kansas City. He's ingrained in the youth space. That's where he was before he came into that front office. He had all these things that made it, and he's like his, you know, the on the field as a, you know, all the everything just made perfect sense. And it was basically them coming in, I think, my recollections, and saying, you are the right man for the job. Come do it. And he did it.
So
and he's done and he's done both jobs.
It's probably unlikely that someone is going to be having that conversation with Carlos Bocanegra.
I just think there are very few, if any, people where that's actually a realistic scenario that you think is going to work. Carlos Bocanegra doesn't have previous coaching experience.
Right.
You know, like,
where do they go?
And that's not a knock on Carlos.
It has to be somebody who has MLS experience. After the last two disasters, it has to be somebody with MLS experience as a player. Like, do you pick up the phone and call Frank Lampard, Andrea Pirlo, Alessandro Nesta? All those guys have coached. All those guys have played in MLS. Nesta actually coached in, I think, USL for a few years as well.
Is there a guy at River Plate that might want to make a change?
I was literally going to make a joke before. I think Marcelo Gallardo may have just lost $1 million just because after GBS and Heinze, and you could say what you want about Almeida, I think there will be debate over his success. I don't know that people are doling out the money for Argentine-based coaches right now. I think it's tough because you're looking at the list. I think you take the list that DC kind of just went through and you look at a ton of really successful assistant coaches in Ezra Hendrickson and Gonzalo Pineda. And I don't think that Atlanta takes that risk right now
of guys who don't have first team experience.
I wouldn't be shocked if there are phone calls out to current MLS head coaches. No one in particular, but it's like there isn't a ton of a long list of people that you can go after, as we're saying, who have already been in this league, who have had that success. There's a couple of guys doing it at a lower level, but again, doesn't sound like an Atlanta hire and doesn't sound like a move they're going to make right now. Outside of Domi Torrent, there is not an obvious name that comes to mind.
Do you wait for – do you just go interim then for the rest of the year and hope that Mexico crashes and burns in qualifying and that Tata's out of a job 3 months from now?
Or you
– I mean, it might not even be qualifying. You might, they don't win the gold cup.
Based off that El Salvador game, you might.
They don't win the Gold Cup, you might get your wish. But then, of course, we've read all the reporting and talked to Felipe Cardenas at The Athletic about that relationship and how it sort of devolved.
And the roster Tata built got torn down pretty quickly.
About like the it's like the plates aren't aligning here. Like whether it be on players or coaches or the stability of the club.
Ooh.
He just took a new job in Colombia, didn't he?
Every job on Carlos Osorio takes has a ticking time bomb.
He's got the bags packed. He's ready to make that. He's ready to do his thing.
He's ready to roll.
Oh man!
Names I thought about, which I think might be too late, is Ignacio Ambriz, who's been super successful with León in Liga MX over the last 3 years. He just went and took over at Huesca in the second division in Spain. It seemed like he left León because he wanted to be a coach in Europe, but second division is not La Liga, and if this is an interesting job, I think that could be one that makes some sense.
Do you look down in Mexico?
Well, that's what that is. I don't know that there's anyone else in Mexico.
Diego Alonso. Like, he's not in Mexico right now, but of course I think of him as a Liga MX coach because he had so much success there. Obviously, it didn't work for him at Inter Miami. I think we have enough data from that Inter Miami team to know that Diego Alonso wasn't really the problem there. Diego Alonso, who won CCL with two different teams, probably still a really good coach. He's someone that if you're Atlanta United, you have to call.
I feel like it's a safe bet to assume Steve Trundle is going to get an interview, former teammate of Bocanegra, and probably Landon Donovan as well.
That is interesting.
But again, I don't know if that's the angle they go for the hire, except if you want a big name and MLS experience winning, blah, 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 Landon Donovan.
Well, you know what? Given where they are right now, it seems culture within the club and the way that the players have thought about and reacted to their manager, again, by all reports, and I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding when you let the guy go 13 games in. The only thing you've heard about Landon in San Diego is that he has the support of his players.
And
but it's his club. But that's his club.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And Warren Smith just left San Diego. So right now it's a lot on him, which I think he values that project. But you never know.
Oh, you never know. We shall see.
I think if you want someone, by the way, who has European experience but has won in this league as well, there's a guy named Charles Desmond Davies. Knows both sides. I think Charlie needs more pressure in his life.
Exactly. He doesn't have enough jobs.
Yeah, I think this could be a good move for him.
That guy doesn't even seem very busy to me. I think he can take this on his shoulders. Atlanta fans, let us know what you think. 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com. This is a story that we are not going to stop talking about. Everybody else is groaning. Oh, God, more Atlanta United. Are you kidding me? Just stick with us here. We'll see where this goes. It's going to get really, really interesting. You mentioned Mateus Almeida, as we dig into MLS Week 13, for what the multiple times now his translator has been ejected. I just want to throw that out there as a funny moment from the weekend. Absolutely absurd. The two matching hand signals and the translator seeing the tunnel in the locker room early. 1-1 draw for San Jose against the Rapids. We won't spend much time on that game. We will talk, though, here about the Sounders. It's over. The dream is dead. They set a mini record per Brian Schmetzer, but then Minnesota United and Adrian Heath had never beat the Sounders before. Well, he now can say that he did a 1-0 win. Seattle obviously shorthanded; they're missing the best outside back in CONCACAF, so it was going to be hard for them from the start. What did we see from this one, Doyle? What do you think?
I love that now it's they were missing Alex Roldan and his brother.
Well, you know what? For younger brothers everywhere, we just need to play that bit up for a while.
It was a scrap, and I just have endless respect for the way this Sounders team has been so resilient through all the injuries and absences that they've had from the start of the year. Like their replacements have replacements on the field at this point, and to go 13 games unbeaten, and I mean they were right in this game up until the very end, where I think they maybe ran out of gas a little bit, and you know, Babello hits that brilliant reversal to get, I think it was Frangipane down the wing to end up getting the goal. Like Minnesota's
I think it was Nico Hansen. Respect Nico.
You're right. It was Nico Hansen. Yeah. Like Minnesota's a pretty good to very good team. And for the Sounders to send almost a reserve squad out there and, you know, almost walk away. Like Seattle's the best team in the league, and you know, Brian Schmetzer has gotten everything right tactically this year, changing formations, shuffling guys around, rotating players to the, you know, as much as he can, getting young guys in position to succeed. Culture is the most important thing. And I don't know how to quantify it. I don't know how to even really explain it. But you see the way the Sounders play 1 through 30 on that roster, and like their culture is so strong. And that is the most admirable thing about that franchise.
What did you take away from Minnesota, Dave? Is this a sort of like over the hump moment for them? Because I wrote before this weekend that they hadn't really beat anybody that you would call a good team so far this year in their little run after that 4-game losing streak to start the season. This is obviously a great team, but it's a depleted team, and it wasn't a vintage performance from them.
No, you didn't see I don't think you saw all the new pieces coming together flowing still yet. Like, I don't think Hunu, Reynoso, and Frangipane, am I going to say it wrong again?
Frangipane.
Yeah. I don't think you saw them link up in this one. And then obviously Will Trapp, not the ideal partner in midfield, Jan Gregus on the bench, which a little bit interesting. So I think for Minnesota, with the start they had to reset and just get points to get back into a playoff conversation. And then you can start to talk about, you know, the soccer that you play and how your team looks. And so they're now sixth in the Western Conference on points and points per game. And these were the types of games you needed to pick up points that maybe were quote unquote unexpected to make up for the ones that you lost out on early on. So I think for Minnesota right now, it's still just a matter of keep yourself in playoff contention while you still get bodies healthy, while you still get players back, and you get it all to mix together.
Hank in Salt Lake City, now that we've got the Sounders unbeaten streak out of the way, another chase for history can take center stage. As best I can tell, no MLS team has ever failed to win a point away from home over the course of a full season. Do the Fire or FC Dallas have a shot?
This is history in a whole new way. You know,
well, that's a different kind of mini record there. If I was betting, man, I'd bet on the Fire.
Yeah, I think that would be the safer money. FC Dallas played Portland off the field for 55 minutes and lost, which may be the type of thing that gets, you know, that might be how those are the teams that it happens to. But yeah.
Let's talk quickly about that Nashville Fire game before we get our celebrating soccer mode of the weekend presented by Continental Tire. Had a bunch of Nashville folks, look, when they're winning, they're hitting us up. They want us talking Nashville. When they're losing, they're like, you don't need to. Don't worry about us. We're all good around these parts. 5-1 for Nashville. Just as much as this was a triumphant moment for Nashville and Hani Mukhtar, who scored a hat trick in 6 minutes, the 10th to the 16th, this was basically back to what we know and expect from the Fire. We've had a lot of mail and a lot of thought and a lot of conversations recently about whether or not they're turning a corner, and Alvaro Madron has been great. Doyle, this was straight back to the Fire of old. This was your captain passing the ball directly to the other team in his final third and 10 minutes in and allowing a goal, then getting a red card that set up a free kick golazo from Mukhtar. This was a comedy of errors.
Yep. I don't know what, I mean, we've talked about it for 4 years. I don't know what else to say. It's just the Fire. This is who they are.
What is this for Nashville then?
So I think this is huge because one of the things I said in preseason was this was one of the teams that was going to be hit by national team call-ups because you had a lot of players who are CONCACAF players. It felt like you had players who would be at Gold Cup. So you're missing Walker Zimmerman, Alistair Johnston. Obviously, Leal doesn't end up getting called up. Godoy. And you go out and get a win, whatever it looks like, and even better that it was fun, exciting. Hani Mukhtar's confident now. The crowd's into it. Like, you add all that on top of this. This is a really good weekend outside of the Walker Zimmerman
I think it's worth noting that Nashville have evolved into a 3-5-2 team.
Yeah.
And the way they played this game in the past couple of weeks is obviously the three center backs and then the two wing backs. Two deep-lying midfielders still, and then it's been Leal as sort of the number 10, drifting underneath two front runners, one of whom is Hani Mukhtar.
Yep.
Mukhtar looks a lot more comfortable and a lot more effective, finding space sort of off the ball or outside of you know, the most congested zones in the field. Like he just wasn't able to conduct the game as a number 10 in the way he was kind of billed as when they brought him in. But now that he has, I think, a freer role and other guys do the work of sort of building the game, he is so much more effective. The caveat, obviously, is that most of these games have been at home. I think they've played 10 home games and only 3 on the road. And that this one, I mean, it's such an outlier of a data point because it's against the Fire. I mean, their last two games were against the Fire and an Atlanta United team that was completely falling apart. Like it's tough to be all in, even though it has looked good.
But you're getting results without your best player from last year and Ake Loba, your biggest signing of all time.
I was just going to say.
Yeah. So
we talked about this. Now, where does Ake Loba fit in if you're going to say Mukhtar's better in that front two group? Does that mean CJ Sapong is gone? Because CJ's been very, very good.
Yeah,
CJ does that Sapong mean that he gone. Moves in for Leal?
No, CJ Sapong's, you just signed a guy at a DP level for $7 million. Sorry. But the other thing is Gary Smith's looked a little dogmatic in the way he saw Leal and Mukhtar for the first year. That has now shifted, whether it's this formation or it's back to a 4-3-3, but instead of Leal on the wing, you let him play inside and Mukhtar can play out wide or deep, whatever it is. It feels like he's at least broken that dogmatic style that he had for the first year, which allows you to be more creative in how you're going to use Loba.
It's a good point, Doyle, about home versus road for Nashville. I got some questions. Also, Chicago have 5 losses in 5 games on the road. Not great for them. Ugly viewing if you are a Fire fan. All right, let's get to our celebrating soccer moment of the weekend presented by Continental Tire. Michael from Montreal hit us up. First time, long time. He says, in the Metro heading home after the insanity that was Club de Foot against FC Cincinnati, as my first experience in person post-COVID, it's hard to beat that one, I have to say. It may have only been 5,000 of us, but the cheers, the chants, the boos, the yelling, the frustration of being down quickly, followed by the highs of tying, and then leading and winning, it was all wonderful and a joy from beginning to end. It just reminded me of what we love about sports, in this case, soccer, the communal moments that we share together. As a healthcare worker, I simply hope everyone continues in the right direction with behaviors and vaccination so that these moments can continue and return to normal all the way. What a moment for Montreal. I mean, this game, just completely absurd in so many ways. A 5-4 win for Montreal. I believe they were down 2 goals twice. Is that right?
Yeah, they went down 2-0
and came back. Wilfred Nancy looked like he was having like a religious experience at times after some of these goals. I was there with him. I was like, how could you not love to play for this man? You know, Mason Toy, nice game there from him. Dave, we talked about it before. Tell people what you were excited about with Wilfred Nancy.
Yeah, so you win 5-4, and obviously you said it. The energy he had on the sideline, especially when they went up 5-4, incredible. The energy in the building for a team that's, you know, been away from home. There was not a lot of value. Not a lot of us trusted them coming into this season. All of that. But then post-game, Nancy wasn't, well, we got to, you know, we're unhappy. Classic coach talk, like, we're unhappy with some of the defending. We know there's things we have to fix, but we'll take the result. We'll move on. It was purely the culture and atmosphere that they've created of we came back and won that game. And that's what he focused on, was the moment and the accomplishment that the players had. Yeah, you never want to give up 4. You never want to go behind. But for this team to not look fazed by that twice and continue to fight and continue to push while missing Romel Kyoto and Sam Piet and Kamal Miller away with national team duty, 3 keys to your team. That was what his focus was on. And we talked about it in the preseason. What's the high level for this Montreal team? So they've already surpassed what I thought they could. So I can't say that I knew. But one of the things was, well, they're like this young culture of no one believes in us and we can shock the world and we're in this together. And damn, they built that in like 3 months and they are ready to rock with it.
They have a game in hand on New England at the top of the East. If they were to win that game in hand, they would be 2 points out of the Revs. Yikes. Right now, they are only 5 points out of the Revs. And remember how we sort of joked in preseason when Georgie was saying, nobody believes in us, you're going to get proven wrong. We're like, all right, Georgie, well, yeah, prove us wrong, man. Like, we'll see what happens here. Well, there you go. And they're doing it, Doyle, with guys that other people at times may not have, I'm not going to say gave up on, but didn't have the same faith in.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that be Wilfred Nancy, the coach, or Mason Toy, or Georgie, or honestly, Rudy Camacho, Struna in the back from Houston. Like,
so what Montreal did over the past year and a half in terms of their shopping, and this is very much the opposite of what Montreal had been doing over the entire previous 10 years. They bet big on players from within MLS. They bet that it was smarter to spend your allocation money collecting guys like Mason Toy, like Georgie, and like Kamal Miller especially. Those three are the ones who stand out, but you're right, Struna deserves to be mentioned in that group as well. As opposed to bringing in high-priced imports and hoping that they can just plug and play and fix all the problems. That is not to say they didn't do that. They just certainly made some moves over the past year and a half, and some of them have been pretty good, others less so. But it was really a pretty bold vision to do that, to find guys who were available within the league and to spend that much money on them, and it has paid off. And part of it is, it's paying off because MLS players, domestic players really, are kind of undervalued still, even within the league. Maybe that's going to change. Maybe we're starting to see that change because suddenly Serie A teams are valuing the hell out of American and Canadian players, and if Serie A teams think they're good, then MLS teams should think they're good. The other part of that is you're
Roma Chiodo to Serie A.
Right. Sorry, the other part of that is you're betting big on Wilfred Nancy and his ability to get the most out of the individuals and the collective. And so far that bet looks brilliant. And what we said in preseason was that he has a chance, it seems, to be for Montreal what Oscar Pareja was for FC Dallas 8 or 9 years ago, or what Jim Curtin's been for Philadelphia. And so far the early returns on that are through the roof positive. And I'm super happy for them.
So that last piece, and I love what Montreal has done. That last piece now is, okay, so you've brought in these assets from around MLS to get results now while you build up what we hope is a new regime, right? We hope Nancy will be there for the long term. They've already given him.
They gave him a contract,
as well as the front office, because their academy was not in a place to push players through. So now can you use this time where you have success to build your academy into a place where a lot of the next players, if you do go on and sell a Georgie, sell a Mason Toy, whatever it is, can they come out of your academy? So they started two academy players against FC Cincinnati. That's great. But what worked for Oscar and has now worked for Jim Curtin was to replace that first wave of players with new academy players going forward.
Some weird moments in this game. Shout out to Brenner for getting his first
open field goal.
Open play goal. Yeah. Took it right off the goalkeeper's foot. But go watch the highlights.
His second goal is absurd.
Is that a back heel?
I have no idea.
I can't tell if that was an awkward finish or a perfect finish.
I have watched it so many times, and I still cannot see how
did
the
contact at the wrong moment, and his foot just like flashed in there?
But it comes off his foot so perfectly. Hard with no angle for that
bizarre.
Play. Yeah.
Bizarre. All right. Congratulations to the Impact. Congratulations to Toronto for getting Josie back on the field and having him score a goal. This was big for them. They're back in Toronto for this game as well against Orlando City. 1-1 draw here. I think, both teams probably a little disappointed with that. But Pozuelo's back. Soteldo is back. Both start. Both go 90 minutes. And they play well. And this goes back to what you said, Doyle, in our spaces last Tuesday. We'll do another one tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern for the power rankings, which is I asked you of the teams at the very, very bottom of the standings, who has the best chance of making a run into playoff contention or maybe, against all odds, into the actual playoffs? You said Toronto. This is why.
Yeah. And they just got 4 points from two games against Orlando City and New England. That's pretty damn good. And I know they're disappointed it wasn't six. I thought they had a couple of chances to take the win in this one. But just look at the amount of talent that they can throw into their attack. Now, I'm still worried about their defense. I'm still not necessarily expecting them to make the playoffs. But this is one of the five most talented teams in the league. It is totally plausible for them to go on an insane 20-game run. It doesn't even have to be insane. Like a really high-level 20-game run that gets them into the postseason. They have the MVP. They have a $10 million winger in Soteldo. And look, everybody seems to I understand why everybody's writing Josie off. Josie's been really good anytime he's played this year. He was really good coming off the bench in this one as well. And Josie, with a plenty of rest and fitness and a chip on his shoulder, and not missing games due to international call-ups, that's pretty scary. That's pretty scary if you're another Eastern Conference team.
Dave, give me the Soteldo scouting report so far.
His feet are so fast, and he's so shifty. Like, even when he lines up a defender with nowhere to go and you kind of already see it coming, he does that thing where he lifts his right foot and just fakes over it, and everything's just moving so quickly. He hasn't gotten to the point where he's able to take that second defender out of the play after he beats his first guy and have a finish. And that's what I'm waiting for. But again, it's his first year in this league. He comes over. It's not easy. Team hasn't totally been there yet, but he has every ability to just be a complete game breaker on the wing when he's isolated, and then come in field and connect with a Pozuelo and maybe a Josie. If it's him that starts to get those minutes where Josie loves to put his back to goal and find pieces, either slip him to the end line or lay it off for him to come in field and get that right footed shot curling. But from a physical point of view and style point of view, he's as advertised right now. He's just a menace down that left wing. Now you want to see a little bit more of the production.
They're missing two starters right now as well, it should be said. The right back, and then honestly Osorio as well. So we'll see if that helps them when they come back. And we'll see if you remember the heater that Pozuelo and Josie got on when Pozuelo got there? That's the sort of thing that Toronto FC needs, and maybe they're going to get it. We shall see. Congratulations to Josie on getting back, getting on the score sheet. Real quick here, let's do some quick hits before we get to the mailbag and get out of here. Vancouver win. We don't often say that, but they did it. They found it.
Is it fair to say three Galaxy players diving to block a shot from Brian White that, while he disguises it well, he's never going to take? Is a bit of a mistake for the Galaxy, but it was a good fight for Vancouver. It was a moment that they needed. I thought Caicedo and Dahomey looked more dangerous than we've seen, and it really has been tough to see how Vancouver can utilize them and how they
can make them dangerous. I'm going to straight up say that I like a lot of Vancouver's young talent. Like, I like Caicedo. I know he hasn't set the league on fire, but he's a 20-year-old kid in a new country in playing in very difficult conditions. The other, you know, it's tough for Vancouver right now with where they're playing and everything, but I like him. I like Kyle Alexandre, who has been awesome. Not awesome. He's been very good. I like Michael Baldissimo.
Who finally came back from injury in this one.
Yeah, I think the world of him. I mean, Ranko Veselinovic is 22 years old, and I know he has been hit and miss, but like everybody on that team has been hit and miss, so I'm not going to blame the 22-year-old center back. Like,
Gutierrez has been good this year.
Gutierrez has been really, really good.
So maybe don't get a DP left back because you're good on
yeah,
that one.
Right. Like, they still need that number 10, right? They
Which
still
it
need
sounds
to,
like maybe
don't
done.
Even. Don't, okay. don't
I don't
even
believe
with the,
that. There's so
hand to the cookie jar.
You know what happened? The Brazilian press discovered the White Caps because the White Caps signed Kyle Alexandre.
It was before that, though. It was before that. They were running them through the transfer rumor mill.
Okay. Well, I don't put a lot of stock.
Is this a 2-year search for a number 10? Yeah. Enter transfer rumors.
Anyway, the point is, this team has some talent. They should not be where they are in the standings. I'm not sure it's a top 5 team in the West, but they have looked hapless for a good long while. And maybe this game this weekend was a signal that things are starting to change. But that, you know, I went back and like the Caps have had 3 winning streaks in 3 years. And
oh Lord.
They haven't had a 3-game winning streak since 2017.
So a winning streak is just back-to-back games.
Yeah. No. They haven't taken 9 points from 3 games since 2017.
I might honestly say that a streak would have to go to 3.
Okay.
You know, like, is that really a streak when you do it?
They haven't had a winning streak since 2017. So all the good stuff that we saw in this game, do not expect it to be replicated.
So
that's not how it has worked for the Caps for a long time.
So you think Atlanta United's calling Carl Robinson? talk about MLS winning streaks.
Well, you know.
Well, I mean, he is a former MLS manager, and he does have silverware because he did win one Canadian championship, I believe, right?
And trophies, you know what? Baby. Next, Alfonso Davies. Make it happen. TBD. Of course, the goal for the Galaxy, you know, Chicharito, but it's produced out of Ligue 2. Revolution. He's looked pretty decent so far for them. Paxton Pomykal returned to the starting lineup. Dallas, as you said, Dave, looks better. Still,
Frank O'Hara is just invisible up top. Like, they did a lot of good things, and they just don't have a center forward who just shows up or affects
the
game.
But they do have a center forward.
Trust me, I know.
On the wing.
Yeah. Like, and again,
Ricardo Pepi deserves, like, he has earned the starting spot. I don't understand what Hara has to do to lose that spot.
And him and Paxton both should have scored, whether they're playing, whether he's playing center forward or not. Like, he and Paxton both had opportunities they should have finished.
That's right.
This was also, I think, the best pop I saw from Paxton just physically. Mm-hmm. You saw him take it in transition. He looked quick. He was clean cutting. So all of that's promising for Dallas.
You know what else is promising? Sebastian Blanco's back.
Yeah. Well, put an asterisk on that, right? Because he played 9 minutes in this, and he looked spry and he looked lively. But remember, he played twice in June, and then he disappeared again for a month, and we didn't hear anything as to why. So fingers crossed that Sebastian Blanco is actually back and that he plays like the guy he was.
Whether he is or not, Portland getting Jimmy Chara back is big.
Jimmy.
Sorry. I felt it as I said it.
Same with Jefferson Soteldo. Same with Jordy Reyna. Getting Jimmy Chara back is big. And like, I know I've been saying this since 2018. They're just so much better with a Bobesy as a center forward. And like, this team has made two great runs over the past 4 years. The run to the 2018 MLS Cup, Obobese was the center forward during that run. And the run to the championship last year at MLS's back tournament, Obobese was the starting center forward during that run. I don't think it's a coincidence. And he, for the final 30 minutes of this game, he played as a center forward. He got the goal. He's a high-level number nine in this league, and I don't understand why they've spent $20 million over the past 4 years bringing in other guys who are lesser players to play over him.
And his quote post-game on the field, I think it was with Jake Zivin, who does a great job, about the goal was, when I get in areas like that, I know that I just need to take risks and take shots, whether it's a deflection or a corner or a goal. And that's the opposite of who he was for his first two or so years in MLS. Like, he has learned that. He is dangerous on top of all of the great things he does besides goal scoring. Now he's aggressive and he's scoring goals, and his celebration was pure striker style. Like, he looks so smooth in it.
Big win for the Timbers. Big win for LAFC. They've got 4-5. Carlos Vela's looking like Carlos Vela. It wasn't even like the chest down goal that got, you know, Max Bredos and company jacked up. It was like all the other little moments where he sees something that nobody else does, and now he's executing on it, whether that be physically bursting in on people and getting passed or just seeing a pass and delivering. Carlos Vela looks like he's close to getting back. Diego Rossi looks good. Sifu looks good. LAFC all of a sudden look good. And this game would have been more lopsided if not for David Ochoa.
Who was awesome.
David Ochoa was un-freaking believable in this game. And I'm not just talking about the PK stop, which is absurd.
He had like a triple save in the first 10 minutes. He saved a ridiculous free kick. He stonewalled a few players. No, he was awesome in this one. And the pieces for LAFC, Kim Moon-Won looks really good as well.
He does.
He's the right back they've been looking for.
It took some time. They eased
still need
him in.
They still need a number nine, though, don't they?
I mean, here's the thing with LAFC.
Let me get the timer up for 45 minutes.
No, yes, because the whole point is that they need to win this year. Mm-hmm. And that's the complicating thing for me this summer with them. Like, does Bob, does John Thorington, Will Koontz, do they look at their roster now that Carlos is back? They still have Rossi, and they're basically saying with the contract extension they made with Atuesta that they're like playing for this cup. Do they say we have enough, or do they have to, because of the stakes here, double down and do it?
They got to double down.
It feels like they have to double down and do it.
So the way I see it is, you started talking about LAFC, and right now I'm in a point where they're just on base. They are an MLS Cup contender based on Carlos Vela's health. If they go out and get a legit nine, you take away that risk. I think their floor comes up a lot, whether Vela's healthy or not. If Vela's healthy, they can win MLS Cup. If he's not, they cannot. If you get a legit nine, that calculation might change slightly.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's the math again. can you get a legit nine that can make an impact immediately and fit into the team immediately? And if you do go out and get another guy with that sort of profile, could you unbalance your team? Could you take away that if Carlos Vela is healthy, we are an MLS Cup contender? Could it throw things off? I mean, it could.
It could, man. But talent usually, like, I like betting on talent, especially when you have a good coach. And yeah. Bob's a really good coach, man.
Hey, how about Brian Rodriguez? He's back.
Mm-hmm.
There's some talent. What about that? How does that
Christian
change?
Christian Ramirez was available for a little while, but now he's
they've already seen. They've already kicked the tires on that talent.
They already kicked the tires on Brian Rodriguez, too. The
Brian Rodriguez thing is interesting. It does make me want, like, obviously they don't have a DP slot open, so they can't go out and get one. But, like, Brian Rodriguez is a full Uruguay international at 20 years old, and I know he struggled to put the ball in the net last year, but he was an elite chance creator. Diego Rossi, there has been a ton of interest in him over the past few years. Like, they have to have the ability to sell one of these two guys. Yeah, I would be shocked if they don't have that ability. And they do that, and the DP slot is open, and then can do some real shopping.
Maybe that's the solution here, is that Brian Rodriguez is coming back, you would think, a little bit humbled, right, from his time in La Liga 2. He's on the left, Fella's on the right, Rossi's back up top. That's the way you run it. You hope that that means that Rossi gets back to goal scoring, like the goal he showed in this game for one, but a golden boot form, and that's how you sell him, and maybe that's how you sell Brian Rodriguez as well, and then you're resetting after MLS Cup win, TBD, I don't know. A lot of ifs there. But right now, on form, our LAFC, but David Ochoa, man. What did you guys think, by the way, about Ochoa going in with L3?
It's totally smart. It's absolutely what I would do if I was a dual national Mexican-American. You have to explore your options, and I don't think there's anything un-American about having ties to your parents' home country, to the country of your relatives. And this goes for David Ochoa, Efra Alvarez, who's now officially cap tied, Julian Araujo, all on down the list. I have zero problem with it. And I just, like, as a U.S. fan, I hope that all of these guys choose to play for the U.S. But I have zero, problem with Io Akinola choosing to represent Canada and being cap tied to Canada now. I have zero problems with Alex Roldan, Eric Zavaleta, and everybody else on that El Salvador team who are dual Americans. Like, this is awesome.
So I would I was also going to add, you get one career, you make this decision one time, it would be wrong to make it without being in both environments. Like, you want it to succeed. You want to succeed at the national team level. We know all of these players care deeply about both these countries, whether it's U.S., Mexico, U.S., Canada, you mentioned, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, a ton of dual nationals across this region, which is a cool part of the development of MLS academies, is more of these players are available for those countries. But also, like, what fits you best? You know, if environment-wise, culture-wise, the U.S. men's national team is the wrong place for David Ochoa, that could hurt his club career and his national team career if you're not able to shine at the best level you can. So it makes you should do your due diligence and meet both parties and see what the atmosphere, the experience, the other players, the coaching staff, the FAs, what all of that is like before you make that decision. It also means that the pressure should be on the U.S. men's national team to create an environment that these players feel comfortable in and want to come into.
And let me just say that everything that you said is right. And the test case or the cautionary tale of making that decision before you have experienced both is Jonathan Gonzalez. He just jumped right into the Mexican camp at the first chance he had to get cap tied. And he is now officially cap tied. And he has not been a part of that team's plans for years and years. So whether it's the U.S. or Mexican national team or Canada or whoever else, I would just urge all of these kids to be aware of each federation's history with this. And I don't blame Julian Araujo at all for turning down the Gold Cup camp for the U.S., which would have cap tied him, and getting more information, because these are I mean, these are long range things. And frankly, Jonathan Gonzalez jumping into the Mexico camp and being permanently cap tied has hurt his career, because I think he would have been a big part of this U.S. national team group. And I think he would have had more club opportunities if he hadn't jumped at that first thing.
Yeah,
and
it's no exaggeration to say that this is these are life changing decisions.
Yes,
it's not just career. This is your life, and certainly getting into the right international setup can change the trajectory of your career, your ability to capitalize on that career, whether it be is your salary from a club or your sponsorship opportunities or just the life experiences that you have.
And I think credit to the U.S. for creating an environment that Sergiño Dest and Daryl Dike and Yunus Musa wanted to come into, and also it didn't feel like they pushed any of those players to cap tie us.
I mean, the Musa thing, like he didn't play in the Nations League, and like it's still not 100% clear why, but it feels like Berhalter saying, you know what, if you're, you know, even 1% unsure about this, take your time. You will still have a spot in the team for the next game and for qualifiers. We'll probably need to know for qualifiers for what it's worth. But like, and Musa came out against Costa Rica and was dominant in that friendly after the Nations League. And I like seeing that culture. I like seeing that what Berhalter is doing really shows some respect for the fact that these kids have 15 years to think about, not just the next three games.
Yeah. And on that note, take that, Italy. Gianluca Busio is ours.
Yes.
You can't have him.
And Nico Gioacchini.
Two Kansas City kids that you were all in on, and they're ours now. Well, Taylor Tolman is reporting that the final signed documents in the medical await this move to Venezia for Gianluca Busio. Of course, Tanner Tessman already there. Taylor is reporting, and I had seen previously numbers like in the 4 to 7 million euro range. And look, you got to translate a little bit here because this is in dollars, that the final number between transfer and incentives, that's basically like, does he reach the plays X number of games? Does this, that, and the other, is $10.5 to $11 million. That's the range. Taylor's saying it should be finalized midweek. You know, this is extra time bingo. We got to get Gianluca Busio transfer rumors into every show. I just want you guys' reaction to those numbers.
From what I heard, and Taylor sort of intimated at this with follow-up tweets, like, it's going to be at least seven. The incentives to that level are very easy to hit, and it gets progressively harder. But I don't think anybody should be surprised if it ends up being a $10 million transfer. And this is what we talked about for years, Weeby and David. Like, getting the Alphonso Davies transfer done and the way he's played for Bayern Munich, getting the Tyler Adams transfer done and the way he's played for RB Leipzig, getting the Brennan Aaronson transfer done and the way he's played for RB Salzburg, has increased the perception of the league and hence the value of the players in the league. And so that's how you get Gianluca Busio going for potentially $10 million to a Serie A club. It seems like a lot to me. It does. But you know what? $14 million for Busio and Tessman combined, that actually seems pretty good. I think those are two very high upside young players. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Tessman walked right into that lineup and was able to compete. I think Busio just needs to work physically to get there. But this is, I mean, it feels like a new era. And then the other thing I thought is, if Busio's worth $10 million, then what the hell is Eddie Atuesta worth? Because LAFC's ownership, they're going to be the world's first trillionaires, because Atuesta is just incredible. So,
it's Tejan Buchanan worth, too. You know? There's a lot of players that you start lumping into this equation and see where it goes. Right now, the reporting from Tom Bogert is that Tejan has a number of clubs following him from the Champions League, from the Bundesliga. There's already been a $3.5 million offer per reporting by TSN that was rejected from Lens in France. So, I mean, there are a lot of names to keep track of. Before we get out of here, any quick thoughts? Anders keeps saying that the Columbus-New York City game, we got to talk about that one. Who's got thoughts on that? Columbus
Nagby
wins.
Scored. That's always fun. And it was an unbelievable goal. Eli Ruhm had to.
That's only kind he scores. So
yeah, Eli Ruhm had to make some ridiculous saves early to keep this NYC, or sorry, to keep Columbus in it. And right now they're a team that's just not performing at a high level.
We said this in the pre-show. We thought that Columbus was going to be the type of team that the Sounders have proved to be this year, because they had so much depth, and they have, you know, a centerpiece player, and Zellerayan is certainly earning every cent of his contract, and a, you know, resilient, experienced back line. They just have not looked good, but they have so much. They have enough talent to brute force some wins, and that's what happened in this one.
I mean, they started Miguel Berry at center forward.
He's looked good, man.
Fair, but like this was
in the final third is legit.
But to the point of this wasn't what we thought this year would look like for Columbus. That wasn't really on the radar when this year started. We talked about their depth. They have depleted through that depth, and now are trying to find even more pieces. But Seattle's done the same, and they've done it well.
Yeah, the NYCFC thing, what I've been saying all year is, if you look at the way they play, they pass the eye test with flying colors. They are fun, good, occasionally devastating team to watch. The underlying numbers all back that up. The box score numbers do not. And it comes down, how you feel about NYCFC, I think, comes down to how you feel about Tati Castellanos. His movement is brilliant. His defense is elite. His hold up play is very, very good. He scored 4 goals in 4 games out the gates. He has not scored in 2 months now. And it's not for lack of chances. He is just, whether it's PKs or one time finishes or sitters or pullbacks, he cannot put the ball in the back of the net. Now, historically speaking, strikers who generate good underlying numbers tend to progress to the mean, so to speak, right? Like, I think he's on like 8.5 expected goals. He's got 4
goals.
Yeah,
he's up at the top of that stuff. Yep.
And I think he's the only one in that top 5 or 8 list who has not scored equal to or above that XG number.
So
to your point, most of those guys have gotten there.
So how do you feel about Tate Castellanos? I think, or how you feel about Tate Castellanos determines how you feel about NYCFC's ability to be a truly elite team in this league. Now, I've said this in the past. Every goal Tati Castellanos has ever scored feels like an accident to me. Like, it's a ball. He has this Jossi thing where the ball is like ricocheting off of him, and he's like falling down, and he's the last guy to get a toe poke. Even though he checks all of these boxes, he just doesn't look like a 15-20 goal a year scorer to me. And I think that puts a limit on what NYCFC's ceiling is. And frankly, it's costing them points at this point in the ceiling, because they are outplaying whoever they're up against basically week after week after week.
The question is if they're good enough, and they've been good enough, because Eber should be coming back around now.
Yep.
To hold till then. And can he find any level of form this season to kind of match in where Tati does all this work for you, and then he can be that finishing piece if he's healthy.
TBD. NYCFC supporters always getting on us. Say we only talk about the club when things aren't going well. But there you go. You got a little bit there, folks. Producing Anders, reminder of the day. You may not know this out there, but Producing Anders' father is a fishing guide in Washington. Go Sounders. Last week, he took a Sounders season ticket holder out who's also a big Extra Time fan. They found this out on the boat together. The guy was enough of a legit fan that he knew who Producing Anders was, said he just listened to our show the day before, and then they had a great time catching King Salmon together and talking MLS. So shout out to that Sounders fan, wherever you are. If you're listening right now, we don't know your name. We don't know your background. We don't know anything about you other than you went fishing with Anders' father. Give us the full story. Give us the full sell on Fjord Shark Fishing Charters. If you are a Sounders fan or an MLS fan and you want to hit the, sound, you want to catch some salmon this fall, Fjord Shark Fishing Charters.
Wear a Timbers kit.
Yes.
Or white caps, I guess.
And if you end up in the water somehow, don't blame
Anders. That's the risk, yeah.
So we need to, at some point, get to Seattle and go out on the charter ourselves, see if you can catch the biggest fish.
Would you eat the salmon? Because you're not a fish guy.
100%.
No, you would. I would.
I would like to not go fishing and have people send me the salmon.
Yeah, I feel personally like undeserving of a fishing trip, because my initial thought was that I would not eat the salmon. But if I'm going to catch the salmon, I should Circle of Life eat the salmon. So if we go and we catch fish, I'll eat the salmon. But I have to be the one. I have to be the one that reels it in. I have to reel the salmon in.
It's time for you to be a big boy and learn to enjoy fish. Yeah. Come on, man.
All right, I'll do my best. Mailbag time, 401-206-0MLS. ExtraMLSsoccer.com. Dave, take it away.
On the last show, Doyle mistakenly called Canada coach John Herdman Steve Herdman. Steve should sound familiar. He is a West Michigan soccer legend who played at a local NAIA school. He now coaches Cornerstone University and played 5 MLS seasons with the Rapids and the Crew. This email came from Steve in Michigan, who follows up and says, "No, I'm not Steve Herdman, I swear."
Well, it's Stephen Herdsman, not Herdman. So that's where that's why when we were Googling Steve Herdman.
Oh, we were just getting some poor unemployed guy.
Right. So Stephen Herdsman, I got a text after that show from the legend Simon Borg himself, who is doing fantastic work right now covering literally everything in the world of soccer for Sporting News. So go give Simon a follow
and,
on Twitter.
And by the way, the Twitter is back from the dead.
Back, baby.
I mean, that thing was dead and buried. That wasn't 6 feet under. It had decomposed.
Wait,
it
who is gone. The D-mid drinking earth. Coffee that was his icon forever?
Mo Saeed.
Yeah. Anyway,
no, it's Minnesota Mo Saeed, not even true Mo Saeed.
I got a text from Simon saying that he makes the same mistake all the time with John Herdman, calling him Stephen Herdsman because of the existence of Stephen Herdsman. It made me feel so much better about myself to know that the king himself, Simon Borg, makes the same mistake that mere mortals like I make.
So it's like every once in a while when we call Daryl Bright and we're the only people in the world who are thinking about that.
Who would ever make that?
No one else even ever knows who Bright is.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I went through, this is another random ETR moment. I went through, somehow I got onto Bright DK's Instagram and I was going through it, and he has a bunch of obviously old photos when he was a pro, like at his top level, where Daryl's just like a kid.
Nice.
And it was an incredible throwback. So go check out Bright DK's Instagram because it will take you on the journey of Daryl from like
good highlights of Julian de Guzman, TFC DP, pulling the strings behind him as well.
Oh man, what a time that was. All right, that's it from us. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can go check out that US Canada react if you want that. It's on the podcast feed and on YouTube. We'll be back on Thursday to preview whoever they're going to play. We don't know yet, between Jamaica and Costa Rica in the quarterfinals, as well as I guess it just depends. Canada gets one, the US get the other, and we will go from there. Enjoy your week, everybody. Midweek action. It's going to be good. We'll talk about it on Thursday. See ya.